On More to Life, we'll explore the life you were meant to live through the theology of the body.
Tune in for great advice, guests, and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us.
Wonderful guest today on Church and Culture. Father Dwight Longenecker is a Catholic priest, but he hasn't always been a Catholic priest. He was formerly an Anglican priest who had the very unusual background of going to Bob Jones University, a fundamentalist school in Greenville, and then to Oxford to study theology. It was there he was ordained as an Anglican priest, served as a curate and a chaplain, and most wonderful of all, a country parson on the Isle of Wight. We might get into that later. He and his family came into the church in 1995. I'm sure we'll talk about the reasons why. And then he became a Catholic priest in when was that, Father Longenecker?
In 1995. Catholic priest in 2006.
Yeah, 2006. So you and your family were Catholic for 10, 11 years before you became a priest.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, before I pummel you with very hard questions about your new book, I want to mention some of the books you've written, because I know one of them is a book of poetry, which I read aloud from once, and they were very fine poems, called A Sudden Certainty.
That's correct.
But Father Longenecker has also written The Gargoyle Code. It's like a Screwtape Letters book.
Yes.
He's written Catholicism Pure and Simple, which is excellent for RCIA and confirmation. More Christianity, which is also a radio show, I understand. So you have a book called More Christianity and a radio show. Adventures in Orthodoxy. And then one that I'm very interested in seeing, reading, My Son, which is about using the rule of St. Benedict to be a parent. What inspired that book, Father?
I wrote that when my own children were quite young, and I am also a Benedictine oblate. So I naturally began to see how the home is a, someone said that the Christian home is the seminary of the Christian soul. It can also be a monastery in as much as it's the core Christian community. And so Benedict's rule for living together in peace with your monastic brethren also helps us to live together in a creative, positive, and spiritual way in our homes.
Well, I think I need that. My son is in 10th grade now, 17, adopted from Romania when he was 4. And he's sort of hitting that age, so I'm going to look around for a copy. We're on this show, though, to talk about your most recent book, which has a wonderful title, The Romance of Religion, subtitled Fighting for Goodness, Truth, and Beauty, and it's published by a very reputable publisher, Thomas Nelson. It's a very nice book, nicely printed. The fonts are large. The pages are thick. And it's a delight to read. What's interesting about your book to me, Father Longenecker, is that I've had a long, long fascination with Romanticism. In fact, my dissertation at Emory in 1979 was on anti-Romanticism, in the work of Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and Baudelaire. And the reason that I did that was because I myself felt such a strong pull of the romantic, the kind of romantic that you describe, or the romance, I should say, and romantic that you describe in your book. I think it's really commendable and valuable that you have actually taken that impulse, and rather than fighting against it the way I did in my young foolishness, that you've actually embraced it. What kind of reaction are you getting to your new book?
The book is getting a good reaction, if somewhat startled by some people, because it's a very creative book, and I'm bringing in lots of cultural references, and it's not a typical kind of religious book.
Oh, and thank the Lord for that, Father. I mean, I must say I just smiled my way through several chapters, because you have the audacity to, you know, show your experience, your education, your deep reading, your understanding of history and culture and of great masterpieces of literature. You don't shy away from making those connections, which I think is one of the great strengths of your book.
Thank you. I'm rather impatient with religious books, which are just going over the same pieties and very often falling into religious cliche of ideas as well as cliche of language. That's okay if we're preaching to the choir, and I don't want to be too negative.
Oh, be negative. I think they fully deserve the criticism that you're giving, because I get beyond impatient. I want to actually take some books and tear them apart and throw them on the floor and ask, why did anybody waste the time writing this, publishing it, and why would anybody want to read it when, as you say, it's just preaching to the choir, it's just making people feel good about what they already know.
And the problems with cliche in religion is that, just as you've said, it actually consolidates some of the worst things about religion. It consolidates bland ideas, trite spirituality, a kind of religious legalism, and lack of creativity and any sense of home.
Mm-hmm.
These bad books consolidate that and make it worse.
Well, they're not. These bad books, unfortunately, arise from bad practices, as you well know, as a clergyman. And I think that my overview of this book is that even though at the surface it's charming and it's imaginative and fun and it shows a great deal of knowledge, it's really quite a slap in the face, a wake-up call, as it were, to Catholics in America who, frankly, you know, they drudge from their cars in the parking lot into Mass, drudge out, get out as fast as they can, try not to break any rules during the week that they have to confess, and then they do it all over again. I mean, that's not the kind of life of faith you describe in your book, The Romance of Religion, is it?
No, and you know, Deal, this really comes from, I'm realizing more and more, my evangelical background. I was brought up in a Bible church in Pennsylvania in the 1960s where the baseline assumption was that if you were a Christian, you had encountered the risen Lord Jesus Christ.
Of course. And you were excited about that. And you were willing to share it.
Yeah. And furthermore, you were there with the disciples on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. You heard him call your name and to leave mm-hmm. your nets and follow him. And your whole life was the bottom line, the expectation, the assumption was your bottom line. Expectation was that you had heard the call of Jesus Christ and your whole life was to be dedicated to him. Whether you were a businessman or a scholar, a mother, a nurse, a pastor, a preacher, a youth worker, whatever it was, your life was to be there for Jesus. And this is still at the root of my existence as a Catholic priest. And
yeah, you've just taken the best part of evangelicalism.
Yes.
And you brought it along.
And my complaint about modern post-Vatican II Catholicism, and don't get me wrong, I'm not one of those who says Vatican II was, you know, no good. It was good, but the result is too many Catholics in America over the last 40, 50 years have adopted the superficial things about Protestantism, you know, bare churches, simplified worship, an emphasis on fellowship.
But they haven't gotten to grape juice yet, have they?
Metaphorically, they have.
Well, you know, I might have you beat on the evangelical background. For example, I've been dunked. Have you been dunked?
Yeah, I've been dunked.
You've been dunked?
Totally immersed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have that even. How many times?
I think it was 3 times, yeah, in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
So we have that. You know, it's funny, you're bringing these things up exactly parallel my experience as a Catholic, though I've been a Catholic a little longer than you have, is that some of the things about my evangelical experience and background that I really liked, I mean, they're hardly anywhere to be found in the Catholic Church, at least in my experience. What about you?
And this is my grumble, that modern American Catholics have adopted all the superficial things of Protestantism, but they've lost. They actually never got the kernel of it, the bottom line stuff I'm talking about.
They never got the fire.
No, and it kind of reminds me, in an obverse way, of the Protestants, on the other hand, who've adopted all the things, the externals of Catholicism, the Anglo-Catholics, who have all the lace and the smells and the bells, but they don't have the heart of Catholicism. And really, my book, The Romance of Religion, in its own way, is trying to say, get right back to the core of the gospel, which is this great adventure that Christ calls us to, which is the life of faith.
You know, I'll tell you, I actually wrote a philosophical article and published it in a book from Notre Dame called Romanticism and Thomism.
Mm-hmm.
And my basic argument was that Thomism, or the view of St. Thomas, was a kind of romantic vision because it was whole, it was complete, it was spread out sort of visually in front of you. And if you move forward to the 19th century, the great romantic painters and poets, I'm thinking now Germany of Caspar David Friedrich, in poetry of William Wordsworth, or even in America, Walt Whitman, or the great romantic tapestries of Hector Berlioz in music, you get a sense of the whole rather than the fragment, rather than the disconnect. Is that something of what you mean by romance?
Yes, I think so. Not just the romantic movement, but I'm using the word romance to tie in with the great story, the great adventure, the great...
Yeah, you use it in almost a medieval way.
Yes, that this is the great... Yeah, indeed, this is the great romance. And, of course, the romantic movement sort of flowered out of that.
Yeah, it rediscovered the medievals, but it didn't really rediscover its theology.
Yes, and I'm trying to get back to that first idea of romance as the great quest with Don Quixote and the Song of Roland and the great hero's quest, the romantic quest, which had in the heart also the romantic quest of the, you know, St. George rescuing the maiden from the dragon and all that sort of thing, and saying, come on, folks, let's get out our broad-brimmed hat and dust off our armor shine up those rusty swords and embark on the impossible dream once again with Don Quixote and Rinpoche and the Three Musketeers and Cyrano
well,
of Bergerac.
Okay.
And all these
May things. I, however, pick on something?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
You're familiar, I'm sure, because you were in Oxford, with C.S. Lewis's view of romantic love. He called it an illusion. Now, he may have changed his mind about that later in life. Talked about romantic love being replaced by a more mature form of love. But I think if you push deeper into that, you come to the great book by Denis de Rougemont, Love in the Western World, where he traces the birth of romantic love out of the troubadour movement of the 12th century France. And his argument basically is romantic love happens when the lovers have a very difficult obstacle between them, which ignites their mutual passion. And if you take the obstacle away, the passion dies.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that kind of sort of objection to your thesis?
Well, I'm not sure that one's understanding my thesis completely, because I'm not really dealing with romanticism in that sense. Instead, the idea of the romantic love comes out in my chapter on the quest for love, and saying that that quest for romantic love or erotic love or human love is always a subplot in the greater plot. And I use movies and hero stories and so forth.
I'm so glad you do that, by the way. It connects with so many more people when you use film. I mean, after all, film is the artistic medium of our age. I mean, we should not stay away from it.
Yeah, and my point is that the most popular kind of movies, indeed the most popular kind of fiction, which is women's romance novels.
Yes, romance novels, right.
Harlequin romance and so forth. That this bread and butter art form that's so much appreciated by the ordinary man and woman, that actually still encapsulates very often the great hero's quest, and that the romantic love is quite rightly in these great heroic stories, even if they're superhero stories and blockbuster action adventure movies.
And by the way, come to think of it, in response to my own question, you really take the notion of romantic love and connect it to the romantic hero more than to romantic pairs of lovers. You're looking at how this quest is ignited and how it is motivated and its vision in the context of the romantic quest rather than love affairs per se.
Yes, but one of the chapters in the book shows how the love affair is very often a vital subplot in the hero movie or the hero story. So typically, the hero rides off into the West having defeated the bad guy and got the girl. But getting the girl is in most of the sort of action-adventure movies a subplot, not the main plot. And that therefore this actually teaches us something about the proper relationship of romantic love to the great romance of the hero's quest. That the hero is searching for love, and he gets the girl, as it were. But in doing so, this is part of his greater quest, the quest to become a hero, the quest to find truth and beauty, the quest to for eternal life.
To die for love, as you say. I'm talking with Father Dwight Longenecker of Greenville, South Carolina. He is presently the pastor of Our Lady of the Rosary Parish in Greenville. First in Greenville, however, been assigned, I think, to a to a school. Or was that when you were an Anglican?
No, my first role as a Catholic priest was chaplain to a Catholic high school.
Yeah, St. Joseph's in Greenville.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, to press this further, it has been argued that the very notion of romance, even as you're using it, and you could push it to 19th century romanticism, was a product of could only have been the product of a Christian civilization. You agree with that?
I think so. I haven't heard it put quite like that, but that's a very interesting idea. And that the idea of, certainly my idea of the romance as the great quest or the great adventure, I think comes out of, I weave this into my book, saying that it comes out of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which always has as part of it, from Adam and Eve being kicked out of the Garden of Eden to Father Abraham being called to the land of promise, always has as a integral part of the plot line this sense of stepping out and moving on and going through the wilderness to find the promised land and going out of the land of famine to the land of plenty and moving on as individuals and as a people to that something which is greater. Christianity, the Judeo-Christian tradition, is always therefore linear. It's always going from the place of being lost to the place of being found, moving
to toward the kingdom.
Moving towards the kingdom, moving towards the land of promise, moving towards heaven. This is why pagan cultures are very often cyclical.
Right.
They have a view of history which is cyclical, and it's an ongoing kind of
very hard on their heroes. They get bumped around quite a bit. But by the way, Father Longenecker, I picked up in your book not just a sense of linearity, say as in the Old Testament, but a sense of verticality. I saw a lot of Platonism in your book, especially in the chapter on beauty. And I'm going to read you my favorite few lines from your book thus far. You're talking about the search for beauty under the title Beatrice, Beasts, and Beauty. And you say, I said, this is on page 83, I said that the physical man must learn to see what is invisible. That is how it is done when we perceive beauty. We do just that. We see what is invisible coming to us through that which is visible. I think that's very, very well said. And it's also very Platonic.
Thank you. I have this thing in that chapter, which is close to my heart, that people, we have not yet given a proper answer and given enough weight to what we call the apprehension of beauty. Very often in our utilitarian age, we write this off as being a bit of rather limp-wristed aestheticism. Talk about beauty is probably for rather effeminate young men who are fond of stained glass windows.
Right. They're all kind of objected to it. When in fact, as your subtitle suggests, beauty is a transcendental of being and an attribute of God. So it's beauty is a way to God.
Yes, I would like us to be having a lot more conversation with the secularists and the atheists and so forth, and saying, what is this mysterious thing which is the apprehension of beauty? That there is something in the human heart which is mysterious and mystical, in which we see beauty and we go, aha, or...
Oh, and it's so powerful, too. It's such a powerful apprehension.
And we can't define this. We know when we go into Chartres Cathedral, everybody knows, it doesn't matter whether they're a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or nothing at all, they go into Chartres Cathedral and they go, this is beautiful. And on the contrary, they go into a parking garage and they say, no, this is not beautiful. Likewise, when they go into a church designed like a parking garage, they say this is not beautiful. And so,
that the mind desires form. I mean, the mind desires order, and that which is beautiful is the mind delighting in the apprehension of form in being in things.
And yes, we can work to make those definitions, and we can struggle to delineate it. In the Middle Ages, they said they worked it all out with mathematical formulas, how to create something which is beautiful. And all of that is true. I'm getting back to that more basic human experience of Joe and Jane in the street, who don't understand all that stuff, but they sure do understand that when they see something beautiful, they know it's beautiful.
Well, by the way, that brings us to one other point I want to pick with you about, and that is in the chapter on beauty, you talk about how beauty often elicits eroticism, but that the desire that's elicited by beauty is not limited to eroticism. Now, my notion of the erotic is Plato's, meaning is eros is the desire for the good. You're using eroticism in the narrow sense of sexual desire.
Yes.
And so I sort of saw the word eros in there, and I thought, can't we find a better word than that?
I think I'm not as learned as you are, Deal. That's the problem.
No, you just don't know as much about eroticism as I do. That's the problem.
Yes. I was attacking the sort of utilitarian idea that reduces the apprehension of beauty to a kind of erotic urge.
Or to sexual desire.
And to sexual desire, yes.
Yeah.
Whatever I see is beautiful. The utilitarian would say, yes, whatever you perceive as beautiful, that's really just an elevated urge in your groin.
Of course, Freud came very close to saying that, too.
Yes, and what you're really desiring is sexual pleasure. And you're perceiving it in all these elevated ways of beauty. Let's get real. It's just in your pants.
But you're absolutely right. The beautiful, that which is beautiful, whether in art or in nature, whether it's people, is most often associated with sexual desire or sexual awareness. It's not identified with something spiritual. It's not identified with something going to the very core of our search for God. And this is the kind of awareness that you're challenging people to have in your new book entitled The Romance of Religion from Nelson.
Yes, and C.S. Lewis, I think, talks about it, I think probably in The Four Loves, but I'm not quite sure where, when he says, when we apprehend beauty, there's something in us which actually wants to eat that beauty or consume that beauty.
Oh, that's a wonderful line.
Or be one with that beauty.
Yes.
I want to be merged with it. And this is where the sexual element comes in. I see the beauty. I want to be one with it. And so all of this is tied up together, and we're not wrong to see the connections. It's just that very often the secularists or the reductionists want to reduce it to mere biology. And we want to turn that on its head and say, no, it's the biology which actually takes us up to the transcendent.
I'm talking with Father Dwight Longnecker from Greenville, South Carolina, or who lives there and is a pastor there, about his new book, The Romance of Religion, Fighting for Goodness, Truth, and Beauty, which is a lot more than a work of imagination, a work of profound education, and of, I think, spirituality. It's really a challenge to the entire American Catholic community. We'll be back in just a minute. Please stay with us for more with Father Longenecker.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, co-publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chaldean News. It's a news magazine for the Chaldean community, about the Chaldean community, and for anyone who wants to engage the Chaldean community. As Christians from Iraq, Chaldeans are proud supporters of Ave Maria Catholic Radio. We invest many hours into this monthly news magazine to keep you invested in the community. You can subscribe or advertise today. Contact us at www.chaldeannews.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
The family is God's first institution. Today, however, with plummeting divorce rates, widespread cohabitation, and the redefinition of marriage, God's institution is in trouble. Join us for a one-day conference April 7th for presenters Jennifer Roback-Morse of the National Organization of Marriage and Harry Bereiser from the University of Detroit, who will share proven techniques that have shown to lower divorce rates and thereby strengthen congregations and communities. Go to dofh.org or call 734-717-1174 to register.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Revival Study. In the 4th century, catechumens, at the Easter Vigil, would process to their First Communion chanting Psalm 23. It turns out Psalm 23 is actually a catechesis of the gateway sacraments of Baptism, Confirmation, and Eucharist. He leads me beside still waters. We emerge from the still waters of Baptism as new creations. You prepare a table before me. Once we are baptized into the church, the Lord lays out the banquet of the Eucharist to nourish us. And you anoint my head with oil. In confirmation, our heads are anointed with oil, and we are forever sealed and identified with the cross of Jesus. And finally, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. The gateway sacraments we have received encourage us all the days of our lives to follow the path of holiness towards our Father's house.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Welcome back with Father Dwight Longenecker. We're talking about his new book, The Romance of Religion. Father, you went to Oxford University from Bob Jones University. You must tell us that story, and you must tell us how that experience went.
Well, it is an extraordinary story. When I was at Bob Jones, we were permitted, while we were there, to go to a little Anglican breakaway church. This was a church, a congregation had broken away from the Episcopal Church, and they belonged to one of the so-called continuing churches, which is a network of basically Episcopalian schisms. And so we were allowed to go to this little church, and I had been to Europe a couple of times as a high school student and college student, and caught a severe case of Anglophilia, the love of all things English. I saw my career path as definitely being an English professor wearing a tweed jacket and smoking a pipe and cycling to classes with books under my arm and so forth. And I was going to be an Episcopal priest, Anglican priest on the side. Well, God got hold of me and helped me to see that my calling was to the priesthood. But I wanted still to go to England and be my dream was to be like George Herbert, the metaphysical poet, hunkering down in a little country parish somewhere and writing poems. And
so you already had that sensibility coming out of Bob Jones University?
Yes. Bob Jones, I was an English and speech major, so I was reading all these great writers and got this case of Anglophilia and had this crazy dream of going off to England to be an Anglican country.
You did. Which college at Oxford did you study?
I studied at the Anglican Theological Seminary called Wycliffe Hall. Along with all the different colleges, which are famous, are also a good number of seminaries in Oxford for all the different denominations. And there were three Anglican ones in Oxford. There was Baptist one, United Reformed, Catholic seminaries, Catholic religious houses. And so Wycliffe Hall was one of those seminaries to train.
How many years did you study at Oxford, Father?
Three.
And did you get your Anglophilia fulfilled while you were there? Did you get enough?
Oh, totally. For an Anglophile and a C.S. Lewis Tolkien fan, Oxford is kind of like Mecca for the Muslims.
How did you get out to the Isle of Wight, which is a place I've always wanted to visit?
Well, after I was at Wycliffe Hall, I met an Anglican bishop who sponsored me for ordination, and I went through the normal channels and was ordained as an Anglican priest. Lived in London for a year, and then went to the south coast of England to serve, as I say, serve my title, which was to be like a parochial vicar. I then went to King's College, Cambridge, where I was a chaplain for a couple of years. And after that, I went to my own parish on the Isle of Wight. In the Church of England, you can sort of, they advertise job vacancies, and if you're a priest, you can apply for them. I was very attached to the Benedictine Abbey on the Isle of Wight called Core Abbey, and I had some friends there, and it's an attractive place, so off I went.
Very historic place. It's very remote. Played a very important role in World War II, but we won't go down that road right now. Another question that jumps to mind when you're using a figure like Don Quixote is that of the Holy Fool. Because, as we know, Don Quixote is not on what we could call a straightforward quest for what is good, true, and beautiful, is he?
He's not, and I use three main characters from drama and literature, Don Quixote and the Cyrano de Bergerac, the hero of Edmond Rostand's great romantic play.
Oh, yeah.
And also Regan Cheap from C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, the swashbuckling mouse. And I use these three characters to say this is the kind of hero we're called to be. Cyrano de Bergerac is like one of the musketeers. He's a swashbuckling character, but he has a huge nose. This deformity makes him ridiculous in the eyes of everyone.
Right, especially Roxanne.
Yes, his beloved, and he writes poems and makes enemies and is a rouseabout for the Lord, you know. And the same with Don Quixote. There's this foolish element. He puts the saucepan on his head and rides out on an old nag and tilts at windmills and rescues a prostitute who thinks he's his fair maiden. And I'm saying the Christian quest, the Christian romance, the great adventure of following Christ is a bit like that. I mean, take the pro-life cause. Here we are fighting against abortion, and all of the governments of the world and the United Nations and all the people like Bill Gates and all the powerful people with money are all lined up against us with seemingly sensible ideas about population control and empowering women and women's health issues and all this kind of stuff. And here we are, a ragtag group of people saying, no, it's killing babies.
This is
the quest that we're called on.
You're holding up, interestingly, some characters from literature who are not straightforwardly heroic, which is good. I mean, they're not knight in shining armor. They have flaws.
Indeed.
And Cyrano de Bergerac, as you know, falls in love with the woman he is helping his friend Christian romance from afar, from under her balcony, where he imitates Christian's voice and woos Roxanne on his behalf, saying things like, "What is a kiss when all is done? A promise more precise, a rosy dot over the eye of loving." Now, who can resist that?
Exactly.
Who can? But then she discovers his nose. And what is, in your view, if you really press the story of Cyrano as illustrative of romance, what role does the nose play?
I think Cyrano has this gigantic nose, and Rostand gives him this as a sign of Rostand's genius, the playwright, because the hero becomes ridiculous. He becomes a clown, and yet here's a man whose heart is great.
Yes.
He loves with all his heart. He's fantastically brilliant. He improvises and composes poetry while he's sword fighting with his enemy. He's a controversialist. He's an essayist. He's a poet. He's an intellect. And he's embarked on this great quest for justice, for truth, for beauty. And yet he himself is a fool. He's poor. He's in poverty. He's been ruined by his controversialism. At the end of the play, he suffers and dies because one of his enemies has sabotaged him and ambushed him and dropped a block of wood on his head. And he dies in the arms of Roxanne in this wonderful way. You're saying, yes, that's the spirit.
That's the way. I'm talking with Father Dwight Longnecker about his book, The Romance of Religion. You know, I'm wondering if these flaws, you've chosen these flawed heroes. Did you have in the back of your mind that you were going to include the fact of our fallenness, the fact of our sinfulness in our quests? So you didn't want one-dimensional heroes.
No, and the foolishness is there. Right there in St. Paul's writings, when he says that the wisdom of God is greater than the foolishness of men, and there's this element in which St. Paul also, when you read St. Paul's writings, he has the same jaunty spirit. Who shall then separate us from the love of God?
Mm-hmm.
Death or suffering,
sure,
or persecution or the sword?
Yes. Almost though I speak with them tongues of men and of angels.
Yes, and he's got this eloquence and this same sort of insouciance when he says, you know, I am the least of all men, you know, and yet I come as the apostle of Jesus Christ. And he comes with that same kind of swagger that you find in Cyrano and these great heroes. And it's there through the gospel as well. Jesus also has this, you know, when he tilts his head and says to the Pharisees, well, then you must render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, mustn't you? Ha ha, gotcha.
Very well done. It's hard to say something new about Jesus or Paul, but you just did. I think that's very well done. And what is swagger in Paul is often taken as a kind of meanness, arrogance, rigidity, which it isn't at all.
No, but and, you're not reading the whole thing, Gil. And
right.
You can also read the passage where he says, I am the least of all men. What I long to do, I do not do, and what I long not to do, I do. Who shall deal with me, such a wretched man that I am? He writes with such passion, and people who only see Paul as this dry theologian, the man who turned Jesus the man into Jesus the God, this kind of Gaze of Hermes stuff is just, it's dull. It's just dull. And Paul is this great swashbuckling character in the New Testament, and people have not really read him completely.
Talking with Father Dwight Longenecker of Greenville, South Carolina, former Anglican priest, about his new book, The Romance of Religion, in which I think, he didn't say this, but I think he's challenging Catholics in America to liven up, to man up, as it were, to get a life, to not look upon their faith as just something about obligation and rules. I mean, does a man or a woman in love follow a list of rules?
Not really. I suppose they should if they don't want to get themselves into trouble to a certain extent. But no, you can't play.
They're not in motion because of obligation.
Yes. And this is one of my grumbles about American Catholicism, that we've turned it into kind of a rule book for respectability. Somebody has said modern American religion, and not just Catholicism, but modern American religion isn't a religion, it's a set of table manners. And we need to get back to a full-blooded religion, which is about a supernatural transaction with the Creator, God. And this is where there's guts and passion. I'm convinced everyone says, oh, why are all the young people leaving the church? It's because they're looking for religion. They're looking for this real red-blooded engagement with all the great issues of life. They're not looking for some dull hobby on Sunday morning.
Well, in fact, table manners is far too generous because you have fun at dinner. And so we need another comparison that is more dreary and more kind of bent over and drug along. I'm not sure what that's going to be. But
maybe the analogy is of the dull boy at school who's been made to do his homework yet again.
Yes, with the and somebody standing over him with a ruler about to smack his knuckles.
Yes, you got that answer wrong again, George.
But you've been, you travel a lot around the country, and you've seen a lot of Catholic communities. I became Catholic in Atlanta in 1984. My first experience of being Catholic was in the South, where you are.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I have found there's a marked difference between Catholic communities, say, below Richmond, Virginia, and above. Do you find that the case?
Oh, absolutely. In the South, we're still a minority. I'm in, by God's providence, I've returned to Greenville, South Carolina, the home of Bob Jones University, to be ordained as Catholic priest. And there, we're in a minority. Therefore, it's very interesting when Catholics move from New York or Boston or Chicago or somewhere, they very quickly pick up that being a Catholic in South Carolina is a different kettle of fish. And they usually become much more enthusiastic about their faith because they find in South Carolina a vibrant Catholic church. Not perfect, of course, but, I mean, in our church, we're building new churches and new schools, and people are getting behind it and making it happen in a way which we don't find up in the northern diocese.
Yeah, and there is also the southern, you might say, manner, thinking of Flannery O'Connor's Mystery and Manners, mm-hmm. of hospitality and of welcome, which really, I think, helps to build a religious community.
I hadn't thought of that. That's part of it. I think also that people are invigorated by the idea that we're a little bit in a minority, that we're misunderstood, and that always gives the edge to religion.
As you travel around, though, do you bump into very many Catholic communities with the kind of that vitality that you're describing in your book, The Romance of Religion?
I find lots of individuals who have this spirit. I find a good number of the apostolates, the new ecclesial communities that have this spirit. I find little pockets of it in parishes. And this is actually a very interesting, we're getting a little bit off topic here, but this is an interesting way to understand the new evangelization. And that is that the new evangelization, first of all, begins in the church. And it works its way through the church by not by imposing systems and gimmicks and ideas from on high, but instead beginning to work with the pockets of genuine spirituality and genuine Catholic faith and life where they already exist. It might simply be you've got three old ladies who meet for a prayer meeting every week, and you begin there to nurture that and grow that. It might begin with, in our parish, for instance, we have a group of people who've been on the who are Cursilistas. They've been on the Cursillo movement. So we're beginning with that handful of people, and things grow and move on as those small groups begin to attract more people.
How does I don't want to let go of discussing your book, The Romance of Religion, but I'm curious if you have any advice for Catholics who would like to see their parish have more of the vibrant characteristics of these other apostolates?
Well, the first thing is not to blame anybody. Don't go through and blame the pastor or other people. Don't make judgments like that. Nothing is worse than sour-faced Christians who think that they're the righteous ones. Instead, just begin where you are. Begin with a group of other people. Start a home Bible study. Start a choral group for your church. Start a youth work, whatever's needed. Get it going. Pray through it. Find the resources. Don't wait to be asked, and don't wait to be thanked. Just get on and do that.
Don't wait to be thanked. That's good.
Yeah, and let them
or recognized, or celebrated, or
yeah.
Written about, right?
Right. Just get on and begin doing that work at a low level where the Spirit is already working. Go with that, grow that, and develop it bit by bit. Also, a lot of Catholics, speaking as a priest, a lot of Catholics think that it's all the fault of the priest and the bishops. Why doesn't Father do something? Why doesn't the bishop do something? We are doing something.
Yes, you are.
We want to go back and say, why don't the lay people get on and do something? Why don't they fulfill their baptismal calling and actually make this come alive and work out their faith in fear and trembling? Getting away from blame, we all have to work together to make this to make the church what it needs to be.
Perhaps if more people took the message of this book seriously, they would feel more motivated. I think we have a lot of Catholics who want vitality. They may not put it that way. They feel the need for community, but they're stuck in certain habits, which you've already described, and you're proposing a new set of habits for Catholics to live. How would you summarize this new set of habits, as it were?
I would come back to the bottom line, I think, deal of saying, have we allowed our religion and our devotional practices to obscure this basic encounter with Jesus Christ? Pope Francis, Pope Benedict, and Pope John Paul have all talked about this over and over again, talking about relationship, talking about the encounter with Christ, talking about really meeting him. And one of the ways to do this, real simple, is sit down and read the Gospels through. Read one of the Gospels. Read Mark's Gospel through from the beginning to the end. We only ever hear the Gospel in chunks at Mass. Sit down and read it like a book. And before you do, pray and say, I'm here, Lord. I want to have this encounter. I want to meet you. Get hold of me and wait for something to happen. This is one way. Going to retreats, learning about prayer, learning to develop your life. It's something which people have to get involved in. It doesn't just happen.
I think the Gospel of Mark lends itself to that kind of reading. It's shorter, it's active, and you can actually read it in one sitting, and you get the impact of the entire narrative, the overview.
This is one of the reasons why I'm taking the time every day during Lent, this Lent 2014, in my blog to go through. I'm doing what I'm calling a bloggle, a Bible study on a blog.
Well, tell us where people can go to your blog.
Yeah, it's called Standing on My Head. Just Google my name, Dwight Longenecker, and
it's called Standing on My Head.
That's the name of my blog. Yeah.
And it's .com or something?
No, it's published on the Pathos website.
It's on
the
Pathos.
I blog at Pathos. It's called Standing on My Head, and every day I publish a short chunk of Mark's gospel. We're starting at the beginning and working through to the end, and then I publish a few paragraphs of reflections and commentary on it so that people can gather the excitement and the sort of edginess of Mark's gospel.
And the it's interesting that if you go to film and look at the film depictions of the life of Christ, whether it's, you know, Rossellini is one of the best, or Zeffirelli, or any of the Hollywood films, you get a sense of tremendous excitement, a man with tremendous charisma, and people who aren't doing anything because they feel either required or obligated. It's out of pure excitement, interest, even love.
Yeah, and that is what comes through in Mark's gospel as well, is this sense of urgency. Mark uses very strong language. For instance, when Jesus, after his baptism, goes into the wilderness, the word is ekphalo. He is thrown out into the wilderness. It's almost like he was thrown by the Spirit out into the wilderness, almost like vomited out. It's like a violent kind of kicking him out into the wilderness. Time and again, Jesus does something, and Mark says, the people were amazed. The people were astonished. The people were saying, we've never seen anything like this before. And because of the urgency of his language, I'm realizing in reading Mark's gospel again, what a brilliant work of literature it is, how the message and the medium are one. Here he's presenting Jesus who's going through life, the world, like a hot knife through butter. He's a man on a mission. He's going from place to place, moving on. And Mark's short, brief, urgent language communicates that all the way through the gospel. So this is a really exciting read.
I'm reading your exciting read, Romance for Religion, and I want to read part of a paragraph that I think where you try to summarize your argument, and that is this. This is the goal of romantic religion, for ordinary people to become extraordinary by becoming who they were meant to be. Not each of us becoming Hildas, catering tea and cakes, but each of us becoming who we are meant to be. This task, then, is the task for everyone in every way through every day. It is to see each day as one page in the great adventure. Finally, it is to see the ordinary life as infused with extraordinary opportunities. Do you think that serves as a good summary of your book?
Yeah, because in the end, I'm coming back, Deal, and saying we experience the hero's journey in great movies, great adventure tales, these great...
In the lives of saints?
And in the lives of saints. We experience these great heroes and see the great hero's quest where everything is risked and they do these amazingly extraordinary things. We do that in order to learn how our more ordinary lives can be heroic in our ordinary quotidian.
And heroicism isn't necessarily visible, is it?
No, and it's very often, in fact, hidden. And it's the person making those small sacrifices continually, the person who's persevering with a terminal illness, the person who's persevering with a difficult marriage, the person who's plugging away at a job to support their family, even though it's drudgery. In all those things... The hero, all the heroic traits are being lived out, but in a hidden way. They're not wearing a hero's cape. And
nobody's going to write poetry about them.
Nobody's going to write a poem about them. But if we have eyes to see, other people are living in this heroic way. I see it all the time as a pastor.
Sure.
I listen to people's lives. I see what they're doing. And as I say, here's a man struggling with a mentally ill wife. Here's a woman who's being faithful to a husband with dementia, and here's a wife who's got a crippling illness, and yet she goes out and cleans houses to support her family because her husband's walked out on her. You know, I see I see this all the time in ordinary people's lives, and that's what we're called to do.
I have been talking with Father Dwight Longenecker of Greenville, South Carolina, former Anglican priest, now Catholic priest, about a marvelous book that I would recommend everyone read, look out for. It's entitled The Romance of Religion, Fighting for Goodness, Truth, and Beauty, published by Nelson, hot off the press. It really is a book you might want to try to put into the hands of your teenage children or young adults. Father Longenecker, thank you for being my guest on Church and Culture.
Thanks for the invitation.
And I hope all of you will come back and join us after the next break.
Is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
When we wonder where God is during challenging times, we can turn to King David for inspiration. After being chosen by God to be king, he spent years on the run. Yet in Psalm 37, David writes, "Fret not yourselves because of evildoers. Trust in the Lord and befriend faithfulness." When we trust in God and befriend faithfulness, we have confidence in our relationship with God. Thus David can say in Psalm 26, "Prove me, O Lord, and try me, for I walk in your faithfulness." This confidence overflows in Psalm 31. The Lord preserves the faithful. Be strong, let your heart take courage, all you who wait on the Lord. By David's example, we know we can hold fast to our faith and trust that God is with us. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan, www.cbsmich.org.
The Ave Maria Radio app is available for all Apple and Android users. Listen to Ave Maria Radio live or listen to your favorite shows whenever you want, on demand. Like what you heard? Post a link on your email, Facebook, or Twitter account in just two taps. You can even leave a voice message on our feedback page. Purchase books or look up references from our hosts and guests, and it's all absolutely free. Just go to the App Store and type Ave. It's just that simple. The Ave Maria Radio app.
Hello everyone, I'm Peggy Stanton, and I'm inviting you to join me this Saturday at 1:30 p.m. or Sunday at 9:30 a.m. for Power from the Pews. Our guest will be Peter Herbeck, host and co-host of numerous EWTN radio and TV programs, a dynamic speaker, author, and vice president of Renewal Ministries.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, host of Christ is the Answer on Ave Maria Radio, pastor at Our Lady of Good Counsel in Plymouth. Ave Maria Radio is conducting its annual spring membership drive April 7th through the 11th, and I hope I can count on you to pledge your support for this vital choice for the Catholic faith. Tune in April 7th through the 11th and make a pledge to help. Call 877-288-1077 or go online at avemariaradio.net. Thank you. And God bless you.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. Ave Maria radio host Sister Ann Shields will give a Lenten reflection Saturday, April 12th at Immaculate Conception Church in Milan. The reflection is titled Prayer as an Expression of Love. The reflection is free and open to the public, men, women, and youth, confirmation age and up. To reserve your seat, contact the parish office at 734-439-2030. Don't miss the Homeschool Connection Thespian staging of Oscar Wilde's The Ideal Husband, April 10th through the 12th at Whitmore Lake High School. This witty comedy takes you to 18th century London. Family rates are available by pre-order only. To reserve your tickets, call 734-484-3497. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, avemariaradio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077.
The Church exists to evangelize, and we, by our baptismal promises, are charged to carry out that work. On our next